This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. When Monica Byrne was approached to write a play about the founder of Planned Parenthood, she wanted to get at something other than Margaret Sanger's biography. So she manifests the spirit of reproductive rights advocate through the story of four young girls. They live in a Catholic reformatory in 1914, and together the girls escape that repressive atmosphere of their school through a collective fantasy life. And Margaret Sanger becomes their patron saint. But things go from mystical to very real when one of the girls gets pregnant. The play is it's a production of the Little Green Pig Theatrical Concern, and it is on stage April 19th through May 5th at the Cordoba Center for the Arts in Durham. Playwright Monica Byrne joins us now. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Hi. Thanks so much.
Tell us a little bit more about this play. Who are these four girls?
These four girls are actually based on friends of mine. I was in sixth grade, and I met three friends who just... You know, we were refugees from cliques and from horrible fifth grade fights. And so we found each other. We began writing letters to each other from around the world, where we would not only take boyfriends at will. So, for example, we all had celebrity boyfriends.
Okay.
So mine was Will Wheaton from Star Trek Next Generation. And another was Joey Lawrence from Blossom. And so we would go around and we would have this fantasy life, and we would also assassinate people who had made us angry. So teachers and boys who had tortured us. And we just got in very much into this fantasy world. And
did you in fact go to Catholic school?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Through 12th grade. So the entire way.
All right. So tell us about the girls now in this play and kind of what happens to them. Give us a little bit of an outline.
What happens to them is they have a legitimate religious conversion experience brought on by Margaret Sanger. So one of them comes in with a whole trunk full of paraphernalia from Margaret Sanger. So pamphlets and birth control devices, things that her mother actually went to jail for. So she brings them in and they sort of treat them with a fascination, and they sort of facetiously set up Margaret Sanger as a saint and sort of facetiously pay homage to her. But then they have a true-to-life religious conversion experience. And from then on, they revere her as a patron saint who is working real magic in them.
It is possible that there are those who don't realize that birth control was once illegal and that it was quite a fight to allow birth control to be legalized in
this
country.
It was illegal to even talk about it. And that's what Margaret Sanger went to jail for. And that's what she went to. I mean, she fled the country. She jumped bail and went to Montreal and traveled through Europe for several months because she was going to be put into jail for even talking about birth control.
So tell us how this play came about.
This play came about when Jay Obirsky, who's the artistic head of Little Green Pig Theatrical Concern, and I were having lunch at Whole Foods Durham. And he said, there's no great work of art dedicated to Margaret Sanger. And to my everlasting discredit, I said, who's Margaret Sanger?
And you see, there
no
are those
excuse.
Who may not know, right?
Yeah, no excuse whatsoever. And then he explained, you know, the basics of who she was. She was a feminist birth control pioneer. And I said, I had already had an idea about writing a play based on these four friends I had. So I said, you know, I'm not so thrilled about writing a traditional biopic. So can I write about how Margaret Sanger influences these four young girls in the reformatory? And he said, sure, do it. So
tell us a little bit more about these girls. They have an actual a spiritual experience. She becomes their patron saint.
Yeah, they have a conversion. And then the primary model I had for the conversion was Saul getting knocked off his horse. You know, he's surrounded by blinding light. He's knocked off his horse. He hears a voice that says, Saul, why are you persecuting my people? And he's blind. He's helped by friends. And he eventually becomes a Christian and becomes, you know, the advocate for Christianity that he became.
A kind of convert. Now, there is a part in this play that focuses pretty heavily on masturbation, and some would consider that shocking to include. But you make it, in a sense, very innocent in this play. But talk
to
that.
Yeah, it opens with that. I remember, in fact, I was sitting down to write this play, and I texted Jay first. I was like, can I open the play with this? And he said, yes, do it.
Yeah.
So it's very innocent. It's very much something cool that they do with their bodies that they don't know much more about, but they don't realize is wrong yet. And in fact, there's a scene later where one of the girls is going through the examination of conscience that they have to go through before going into the sacrament of confession. And And I remember this question very clearly. Have I touched myself impurely? And I didn't know what that meant for years. I was like, what? How can
wash
you not
my hands?
Purely?
What
yeah,
do you mean
exactly. Do I need to put on Purell or what? So, but then that's when she realizes, wait, that's wrong. This thing that we do is actually wrong. That is just sort of fun and innocent and a sort of bonding experience that we have. And it's not, I mean, one of my concerns about this play that we definitely avoided was instituting a sort of male gaze where like, oh, you're watching young girls masturbate.
Right.
No, it's, you know, it's very low light. They're very innocent about it.
What you do then is you bring attention to the fact of this idea of agency, of control over your own body, which is something we, for a time at least, believe we have. And then there's a moment or a period of time in which that agency is removed. And if you're a woman, it happens in a very special way. Although if you're a working class or poor man, it happens as well in this society.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these women were the definition of disenfranchised. I mean, they didn't have anyone to take care of them. I think the very best outcome for them would have been to go into another better reformatory or get a job working at a mill. I mean, they had no options whatsoever, and even fewer options over control of their own body, because birth control existed, you know, in 1914, but rich women had access to it. Rich women had access to doctors who gave it to them under the table. Poor women had no knowledge or access about it whatsoever. And that's what distressed Margaret Sanger so much, was the idea that basically for women to stop having babies and, you know, doing self-induced abortions and dying was to stop having sex, which was not possible.
It wasn't quite an option, no. And women with many, many children would come to her and say, how can we stop this? He's insisting. I can't really stop him.
Yes.
And for women of particularly Catholics who wouldn't have an abortion, isn't there some other way? And that was what she saw day after day after day in her work.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what now, this is takes place very specifically in a Catholic school. So are we to take from this that this is about Catholicism and its control? How broadly do we see the picture?
Good question. I would love to universalize it. I mean, I don't
Catholic
think
means universal, so you're right.
right. Small C Catholic. I think I said it in a Catholic reformatory because Catholicism is such a deep vein for me. I could write, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 plays about Catholicism. But I think more universally what it means is that if information is withheld, then people suffer. I think that is the broad message that comes across, regardless of whether or not they're specifically in a Catholic reformatory.
And we can't get into the details. I think that would ruin a couple of lovely twists in this. But
there
is information that not everybody has access to along the way. So how much of the story, what role then does Margaret Sanger play, and how much of her life story do we get, or do we get any of it?
We get very little. I mean, we basically get a picture in the newspaper that they set up, and we get newspaper stories. So they're following her adventures in Europe. But otherwise, they sort of adopt her and distort her as a saint. I mean, we have a very clear conception of who and what Margaret Sanger is now, but to them, when it was just happening, she was indistinguishable from, you know, Elizabeth Ann Seton. Or she was indistinguishable from St. Lucy or St. Joan of Arc. She was a hero to them. And so they set her up as their hero. And so her actual details of Margaret Sanger's life is not actually all that present. And that's another part of the point, is that they don't have much information. And so they make what they can out of the information they have. And sometimes it is destructive.
How did your understanding of Margaret Sanger, the person, as a sort of a biographical, biological person, change, or did it, in your research for this?
Well, I started knowing nothing, which again is just, there's no excuse for that. I took all the wrong classes in college. But I read her autobiography. She was amazing. She traveled all over the world. She traveled to Japan, to India. She was fearless. She was consistent. She really took no prisoners. I mean, she spoke about being nervous, but whenever she got in front of people and was just like, you're stupid to not believe this. And I really liked that about her. You're an idiot listen to this. This is, I'm right. I'm right about this.
And what is it that you want us to take away? Is it the sort of the impact of Margaret Sanger? We've talked about some of the other themes, what happens when you don't know enough and don't have enough control. Mm-hmm. So certainly that's part of it. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that we need that you would like people to come away with in terms of their understanding of Margaret Sanger?
I think, to me, there's an idea that women encounter ceiling after ceiling, like they break through a ceiling. So the women in this play break through a ceiling where, oh, they create this incredible fantasy world and they're incredibly happy about it. But what they don't know is that there are many more ceilings that they have to break through to actually fully inhabit and own their own agency, which is the tragedy of the play. I mean, they've broken through one ceiling in this play, and that's it. And they never realize how many more ceilings there are. And so I think what I want people to take away from this play is that you sometimes have to take incredibly radical steps to align how you feel inside with what you're actually doing. And these women, I mean, it's up to the individual audience members what they think happens to these women after the play.
Now, it's set in 1914. There's
yes.
certainly a lot of parallels with what's happening with women today.
Yeah.
are we sort of meant to see that? Is that gap, that distance, does that give us a particular point of view? Could it have been set in 2012?
Maybe. With some tweaks. I mean, the play was commissioned 2 years ago, so we could never have envisioned or anticipated that this would be in the news again. And I mean, maybe it's a defense mechanism, maybe it's naivete, but I just can't take it seriously. Like, the idea that birth control is controversial in this day and age is hilarious to me. And so when, you know, when these things come up, I'm just like, oh, this is just a reactionary hiccup and it's going to be over soon. Nevertheless, I'm very glad that this play is going up at this time. And I think it is incredibly, it's an act of God, maybe, or an act of Margaret Sanger, that it is happening at the same time that this is so much in the news.
But it is proof in the sense that the argument over control, who gets to control women's bodies, may never have died.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. And I mean, the main thing that I keep reminding myself and everyone else of is that women are human. And that sounds like the most basic thing. But the idea that women are a special kind of human is prevalent everywhere. And it amazes me. It amazes me even in my own work. I have to fight against that conditioning. And a very basic tenet of what it means to be human to me is to have agency over your body.
That's an interesting thing, a problem for a writer, isn't it? Because on the one hand, culturally, in terms of the way women are viewed, that's what you're dealing with, the difference.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The fact that you've been put in a different place.
Yes.
So then to sort of get at the humanity over and against the cultural artifact that women have become, not through their making.
Yeah, no. I didn't ask to be born in a female body. Nobody asked to be born in the body they're born in. But we're all human.
So tell us, this is your second produced play, and you were on the show for your first one, Night Work. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, did any of that experience of writing that play play into making this one?
Well, this one went very differently. Night Work, I wrote it, and it was pretty much, you know, it didn't need any editing. It went up 2 years later, pretty much how it came out. What Every Girl Should Know, I think, because it's so steeped in issues that are incredibly important to me, like women's bodies and Catholicism and religious experience and storytelling. I could have written, you know, 5 or 6 different plays about this subject. And I did write 3 major drafts of it. And in fact, I was traveling in Central America a couple months ago and had a nightmare that Jay canceled the play. So I started rewriting it from scratch longhand in Costa Rica. And I'm so glad I did.
Have you been moved by mystical experiences?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. From a very young age. And I had parents who very much encouraged the notion that religious experience was not confined to church. It was everywhere, all the time.
Well, we are looking forward to your next play and this one, which is still on stage. Monica Byrne, thanks you so much for being on the program again.
Thank you for having me.
Playwright Monica Byrne's latest play is called What Every Girl Should Know. It is in production. Little Green Pig Theatrical Concern is putting it on April 19th, so it's already underway, through May 5th at Cordoba Center for the arts in Durham. More information, go to littlegreenpig.com. That's State of Things for today. Our website is stateofthings.org. And today we say goodbye to our intern, Megan Modafferi. She's a very quick study. She is a credit to UNC. I have to say, as a rhetoric student, she will do all of us proud. Fantastic intern, produced many of our best segments this semester, including today's discussion on the proposed constitutional amendment. Very difficult thing to pull together. Megan, we will miss you very much. We wish you many great adventures. In fact, she's going to the most beautiful city in all the world, Prague in the Czech Republic. Šťastu, čestu, which is some version of Bon Voyage. And so this is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We leave you now with the Prague Film Orchestra playing the overture to the film Bon Voyage.